Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Last week, a federal judge sentenced the leader of a splinter group from the polygamous sect, the FLDS, to 50 years in prison. His name is Sam Bateman, and he pleaded guilty to conspiracy to transport a minor for sexual activity and kidnapping. It was a plea arrangement. Essentially, what he did was admit that he had more than 20 so-called spiritual wives. 10 of them were girls. One was only 9. And he admitted to sexually abusing almost all of them. In 2019, Bateman had declared himself the prophet of the polygamous families who were part of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We spoke recently with the photojournalist Trent Nelson and the researcher Lindsay Hansen Park about this story. And they told us the community had been left adrift when their leader, Warren Jeffs, was arrested in 2006. Bateman and a friend, Moroni Johnson, took advantage of the power vacuum in that community.
Are you Warren Jeffs?
Yes.
All right, Mr. Jeffs, you're being held as a fugitive, and there are two fugitive holds for you, one from Utah, one from Arizona. I'm going to explain to you very quickly what your rights are in regards to being a fugitive from justice. Then you tell me what you want to do.
A jury has now been selected, and the trial is about to begin in the case against polygamous sect leader Warren Jeffs.
Yeah, the 55-year-old is being charged with two counts of sexual assault, one with a girl as young as 12 years old.
Jeffs is guilty of sexual assault of a child, an aggravated sexual assault of a child. That ruling came down just over an hour ago.
Polygamous leader Warren Jeffs just sentenced to life in prison a little less than an hour ago.
In the FLDS community, Warren Jeffs is the prophet, and the prophet arranges the marriages. It's his role, and he performs the ceremonies. And so, with him in jail and then in prison, this process stops.
And people were still waiting for him to give direction from prison. He would give revelation or directions to one of his family members, one of his wives or brothers who had leadership in the community. And then that would get out to the followers. But over the years, especially since 2010, and as he's been in solitary confinement, his revelations are getting more incoherent, and his followers are getting more fractured. And over the years, he's lost control, and a lot of the men who were working for him as caretakers or counselors or leaders have realized that Warren just has no power.
Warren's in jail. People are going to visit him and bringing out messages, but there's not really a verification of, is that what he really wants? Is that what he really needs? Of course, the people have faith in that, but there's always room for, what do we need to know that we're not hearing? Why are we going down this road?
So a lot of them have stepped up and tried to take power.
And in 2011, Warren Jeffs' brother Lyle is the bishop in Short Creek, and they come up with this new system where they re-interview all the members and determine who's most worthy, and they create kind of an elite group in the church called the United Order. And at that time, a lot of new rules come into play as well. And even couples that have been married and have kids are told they are no longer allowed to have sex. There are no more children at that point from even people who'd been, you know, married before. So you set the stage for these people who have just really lost this major element of their lives, what they find happiness in, family, children, each other. And that continues on until late 2018 when Sam and Moroni begin figuring out a way around that.
Warren Jeffs really showed the men under his rule how to take power. You can just claim it if you have a really good story. And Sam Bateman's story wasn't particularly unique, but he did something that I think is interesting that probably compelled a few folks that was different. He encounters, I would say, New Age spirituality. I don't know how he did that. I don't know if he was on the internet. But he starts integrating this idea of like manifestation, like coordinating it with FLDS doctrine. So I think as the Jeffs family have been prosecuted and their powers and property and money and resources are taken away, it leaves opportunities for, I would say, lower ring leaders or influencers like Sam Bateman, who frankly are just not as intelligent as Warren Jeffs. But he didn't need any sort of intellectual prowess to do what he did.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the rise and fall of Sam Bateman because it can tell us a lot about the culture of these Mormon polygamous offshoots. How they work to manufacture predators, as Lindsay Hansen-Park put it, but also what's left of the FLDS community. Bateman's story was told in the Salt Lake Tribune recently by Trent Nelson. He's a photojournalist who reported the story, along with the journalist Jessica Schreifels. And I should mention, the story also involves a really interesting character named Christine Marie. She's an advocate for the people in that fractious FLDS community, and she and her husband, who's a filmmaker, provided crucial evidence in the Bateman case. Here's Trent Nelson again.
In 2021, in July, I went down and stopped in at some sources' houses. I went to Christine Marie's house, and she said, "You should have come yesterday. Samuel Bateman, the new prophet, came by with a trailer full of his wives." And I thought to myself, oh, I really wish I had. So I knew this is something that was on my radar and I was very interested in. But as I started to hear more and more, the next thing I heard was he'd probably let you come by and take pictures. So I was kind of excited. But then I started to hear there's probably really bad things happening. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I also heard there's an investigation. And at that point, I could not figure out a way that I would feel right doing any coverage until he's arrested. I just could not put myself in that house. And so it was a waiting game. And then I was getting calls, any day they're going to arrest him, any day they're going to arrest him. I was just following along, but we never really knew when that day would come.
What did you make of the fact that she thought Sam would let you come and not only talk, but even take pictures? Like, what did that tell you about Sam Bateman?
It's this dual aspect of this person that he's doing these incredibly monstrous acts, but he wants to be famous. He wants to be seen and be heard. He had a YouTube channel. He was wanting to be rich. He wanted to be that famous leader.
What do we know about Samuel Bateman's background before he declares he's prophet? Who is he years before that?
So he grew up in Short Creek. He grew up FLDS. So he's from that community, kind of had a pretty, you know, normal childhood there. His father was a science teacher, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Who actually ended up kind of moving away from the church. And then it was the 90s, I think, he got into this really bad car accident that affected his personality, his memory. He had some brain injury associated with that. And coming out of that, everyone we talked to who kind of knew him as a kid and then saw him after this accident said that he just became a totally different person, that he was a lot meaner, that he was kind of an asshole, and that he was really, really religious. I mean, everyone in the FLDS community is pretty religious, mm-hmm. but his dedication to being in this religion just really doubled down after this brain injury and really changed his outlook on life and the way he interacted with people.
So his father, as Jessica was saying, I guess he becomes an apostate,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Do we know what impact that had on Sam Bateman, who becomes really doctrinaire, really rigorous religiously? Does that have any impact on him as far as we know? Does anyone talk about that?
I guess what you can say about that is Warren Jeffs goes to trial in 2007. It's a small courtroom in St. George, and the FLDS are given maybe a dozen passes for supporters.
Yeah.
And you would imagine that in that community at the time, we're guessing 10,000 members of the FLDS, to be one of those 12 is a big deal.
Yeah.
And Sam Bateman happens to be one of those 12. Now, there's a lot of speculation. Was that a move to, you know, put him in there to put a thumb in his dad's eye, like, oh, your son's supporting me and here I am. But the interesting thing that happens out of him having that pass and being in court every day is that that kind of props him up a little. It gives him something to say, hey, I'm special, I'm important. And he can use that as he builds his, you know, in 2018, he starts to build his own thing. He's got that as a prize.
Let's talk about his own thing that he starts to develop. He does this along with a man you mentioned, Moroni Johnson. Talk a little bit about the teaching that they're starting to express. You mentioned in your piece they start teaching that women could now pray and receive revelation about marriage for themselves, that I guess, hey, you don't need Warren Jeffs. Talk a little bit about what he and Moroni are starting to say to the people there.
Yeah, that's really interesting because they want kids. They want sex. The men, the women, the adults, they've gone all this time. You think of there could be young women who are now 28 to 30 years old by – this is late 2018. You could be almost 30 years old and never married, never had a chance to have kids. And you've grown up in a culture where that's the goal for a young woman possibly.
So they're in this long limbo. Mm-hmm.
Right. You're missing out on the biggest blessings of what you've been taught all your life. So there is this urge. And when Sam and Moroni start teaching this, it's not like just to their family. They're trying to recruit anyone they can in town. But there's also this network of caretakers in the FLDS system where Moroni, for example, is watching over several single women or single moms or people who need a priesthood leader. And so in that role, he's teaching their Sunday school classes every morning, every night. It gives him a way to also spread this message to other people.
How is this received among the FLDS leadership that now Moroni and Sam are saying something that might be contrary to what they've told their people?
Yeah, there's three sets of reactions here. The FLDS are, you know, what's the right word? Offended. It's heresy. It's, you know, apostasy. They're very upset about it, and they try to dissuade anybody from moving that way and following Sam's new teachings. The leadership, Warren Jeffs puts out a revelation through his son Helaman, basically saying Sam and his followers are evil men, you know, and Warren's still the one that you need to be listening to. So they make every effort they can. And then interestingly, the ex-FLDS, who are called apostates by the FLDS, the people in town who aren't religious anymore or anything, to them it's kind of a comedy show in a way because we don't know the horrors yet. But they knew that they could listen in on some of the teachings and things over the phone and call in with little pranks and stuff. So it had these three different responses, but no one was really buying it other than a small, you know, subset of people.
So it seems like then 2019 comes around, Bateman and Moroni are asserting this new teaching, and then they leave. They go to Nebraska. What happens next?
Basically, Moroni and his family go to Nebraska to work, to find, you know, a better income, and Sam will come pop over and visit, and then another family will kind of come over and visit. But Nebraska kind of becomes where it seems to all kind of take hold, and Moroni marries three or four women like that year of 2019, like really fast. And so that brings him up, you know, probably to about six wives as best we can tell. And then Sam somehow becomes the person who's seems to be the teacher, the leader. And he marries one of Moroni's daughters, who's an adult, but probably half his age.
Yeah.
And then after that, the two of them talk the next oldest daughter to marry. As this is happening, Moroni's wife, Julia, is seeing this and is starting to be troubled. She's already troubled that these marriages are happening against the wishes of Warren Jeffs, but also it's her daughter now, and it's not being done in a ceremony. It's not being done by the prophet. Her daughter doesn't have a chance to show her consent in front of witnesses and the family, stuff that she thought was important. After those two sisters, Bateman marries a 9-year-old, and now Julia is just very upset.
It's one thing to say that a young woman is getting married at the age of consent, you know, 16, 17. This happens all the time in the FLDS community. But 9? 10? Is that an anomaly? Like, how are you guys thinking about that part of it? And what does this?
I think there was at least one of his male followers who I think told one of his kids that 8 or 9 was the right age to be marrying girls. So there were some people who were pedophiles who thought that is appropriate. I think in the community at large, that is not appropriate. You can see that in the way that the community responded. A lot of them were calling the police. They were reporting this. Arizona child welfare officials were coming in, asking questions. Of course, it's hard when the parents of these girls are saying everything's fine. Mm-hmm. So they didn't get very far. But the community was not going to just sit by and let this happen. They thought it was very inappropriate. But from what we can tell, as I mentioned, the child welfare officials couldn't really do a whole lot with the way the parents had kind of responded to them. And with the police, the reaction was kind of like, well, if you just call somebody your wife, that's not a crime. We need more evidence that there's any kind of sexual abuse happening. Just saying that kid's my wife doesn't really prove anything.
I have to ask this question. These marriages with these young women, these were sexual relationships, right?
All of them but one.
Okay. Because I wonder if there was some idea that they would become sexual once there was an age of consent attained, and that these were just sort of spiritual marriages. This became an issue with Joseph Smith, where the allegation that they weren't all consummated, that they were more just sort of intimate connections rather than sexual connections. How does that play out here?
That's definitely not the case, what was happening here. Yeah. And we know that from his own admissions. Like, when he eventually pleaded guilty in court, he admitted that he had taken 20 wives. 10 of them were under the age of 18. And the primary purpose in taking those wives was to have sex with them. And that included all the little girls as well. So that seems to be his primary purpose in this, was to have sexual contact with all of these people he had taken as his wives.
And it is interesting, too. We saw that, as you mentioned, with Joseph Smith. We saw that with Warren Jeffs. We see a photo of him with a 12-year-old, and that other story could be they're just spiritually sealed for now, and there's nothing going on. But what's interesting in this case is when Christine Marie and Tolga Kadas, the two who eventually bring the evidence to stop this, when they first see him with these young girls – Tolga thinks, no, there's nothing going on. There couldn't be anything going on. But Christine thinks immediately, there's probably something going on.
Trent Nelson, he's a photojournalist with the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been reporting this story for the paper along with Jessica Schreifels. We'll put a link to their series on the rise and fall of Sam Bateman on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the self-proclaimed polygamous prophet, Sam Bateman. The Salt Lake Tribune's Trent Nelson and Jessica Schreifels have been writing about the rise and fall of Bateman, who was sentenced last week to 50 years in prison for taking 10 girls as his so-called spiritual wives and sexually abusing most of them. The story says a lot about the culture and the future of the FLDS community. Well, let's talk about Christine and Tolga. Tell us who they are.
So Christine Marie moves to Short Creek in 2016 with her husband Tolga Kadas, and Christine runs a charity called Voices for Dignity. And she moves into town hoping to just help people. And Tolga is this – Tolga grew up in Turkey. He's a larger-than-life character.
They're both larger-than-life.
Yeah. and Tolga can take over a room.
Yeah.
He's funny and has a lot to say. But Christine quickly – since she offers a harm reduction approach, the door's open. Anyone can come in for help. And a lot of the charities in town
– explain what you mean by harm reduction. Like,
yeah.
No judgment.
No sides, only love is the sign in their house.
Huh.
So you don't have to be escaping polygamy to get help. You don't need to be in the FLDS to get help. You just need to show up.
Yeah.
And so she'll help anybody. And her house is a revolving door of people coming in, getting things – checking in, coming in with a problem. I was there last month, and a fourth grade teacher at an FLDS school called her and said, Christine, will you go on the internet and Google a fourth grade class lesson called rice pudding and send it over? Because this woman didn't feel comfortable on the internet. So Christine is kind of this middle person doing all these different things for people in the modern world.
At what point does Sam Bateman then you said at first it seemed like early on it could be Moroni or it could be Sam. Sam rises above, right? At some point, I guess he becomes – what, does he declare himself the prophet? Is it just thought that he's going to be now the new leader? And at what point do they become Samuelites? Because that's, I guess, the word that you hear, the followers of Sam Bateman.
That's really hard to know exactly, even with all the information we've been able to go through and look at, even some inside sources. It's really hard to pin down when, like, specific titles were given or ceremonies were conferred, because I think it was very casual. I think it was just kind of – things just kind of gradually happened.
Huh.
And I think from everything we can see, Sam seems to be just – trying one thing after another, seeing how far he can go. Like, I'm going to marry your daughter, now your next daughter, now this one who's clearly younger than anything we've seen in this kind of a situation. So I think he's just gradually creeping and grabbing power. And he ends up moving back to Colorado City into this giant 16-bedroom house they call the Blue House. And he takes the top floor with his wives. No one else is allowed to go up there. I think a lot of this stuff just kind of gradually happens. And he's probably in his mind, he's just realizing he can keep going further and further.
I was going to, but he does at some point start declaring, I am the prophet, and start saying that either Warren Jeffs is dead or that he's been translated. And basically, like, Warren's talking through me now, so you have to start listening to me. So now it's going beyond the... You know, women can decide for themselves whether, you know, the marriages and the kids happening. It's, I am the new prophet. I'm the new leader. And he had complete control over everyone's lives, all of his wives, all his followers. He really controlled almost every minute of their days.
It seems like he has, I don't know, I'm not going to psychoanalyze the guy, but it just seems like he has constructed this narrative or this fantasy for who he is and where he might fit in this new universe he's trying to create. There's this interesting moment when he is interacting with Christine Marie that you write about, where he uses this elaborate language. Let me read part of this. They're going somewhere and he's wondering if it's going to cost money. And as opposed to saying, hey, I don't have any money to pay for this thing, he says, if where we are going tomorrow requires pecuniary additions, I am apologetic in saying that. And it goes on for there. And it's just, it's this kind of piss elegant, affected, ostentatious kind of way of writing, kind of mannered and pseudo formal. Does that say something about the way he's thinking about where he fits in the scheme of things?
I mean, one thing I thought was really interesting, you know, as I said earlier, I came into all of this totally cold. And I think as we were talking with people, you would kind of be like, I imagined him to be like really charming, very smart, very charismatic. And everyone we talked to was like, no, that is not who he was at all. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't that smart. He's not, you know, like, there's videos of him that Tolga took where he's like, hey, like, watch me do this. And he's jumping from like rock to rock thinking he looks like really cool and he's going to intimidate the police. But he looks like a toddler, like, waving his arms in the air. Like, he has this persona of who he thinks he is. He thinks he's just like this great, famous, smart person. And that doesn't really match with when you go talk to the people in the community. That's not really how they saw him, which, as Trent was saying, you know, some of the people who were the apostates in town were kind of like laughing at him before they realized the horrible situation was going on, because to him or to them, they just seemed so unserious the way he presents himself at times.
Yeah. Tolga tells a great story of going out into the desert canyons with Sam, and they were going to Sam wanted his visions and his religious experiences filmed. Mm. And so Tolga gets set up and Sam's standing on a rock and he starts to tell about some vision he had. And he says, okay, I was standing here. Oh, no, wait. I was actually over here. And over here, this happened. Oh, no, it was over by that tree. Like, Tolga clearly could see that.
He's making this up.
He's making it up, and badly. You know, he has no idea of what he's even saying. So we haven't seen any real indicators that there's like a book of scripture that he produced, mm-hmm. or a set of guidelines. It seems like it was just like whatever Sam wanted to do, he was going to make it happen.
Sam has no idea that all this filming that Tolga is doing is basically collecting evidence. Right?
Right. Tolga had been working on a documentary about the FLDS community for several years. And Sam knew about that, and he really wanted to be in that documentary. And so that was kind of the link to get the filming going. And then gradually, I think Sam starts to just think that the documentary is about him, mm. because they're filming all the time.
There's a moment you tell, it seems to be kind of a clincher moment for Christine when she realizes that he is not just someone who is trying to be prophet, but a really bad guy. Will you talk about that moment in the car?
So Sam calls up Christine and Tolga. He wants to tell them something important. So he comes up in his Bentley to their house, picks them up. There's a second Bentley following with some other followers in it. But Tolga gets in the passenger seat. Sam's driving. Christine gets in the back seat with three young women. Really, it's two young women and a 13-year-old girl. Sam begins to tell them about this religious ceremony he came up with called the Atonement, which basically is he had other followers abuse these three women sexually. And Christine is just in shock. She's been told by the police for months now that she needs better evidence, that, you know, they need to have more information to stop this. And she thinks this is it. He's confessing to this awful, monstrous thing. So even though she's next to these three women who are, by the way, devastated and crying, confirming what he's saying because they're the victims, she reaches down into her purse and secretly brings out her phone and hits record and captures that audio of that moment. She gets home. And before she gets home, Tolga and Christine have to pretend like this is normal. They can't show any reaction. They get back into their house, and she immediately calls the police. And she says, I've got it. I've got the bombshell you've been waiting on.
Let's talk about the extent of his child sexual abuse. One of the things you mentioned in your reporting is that Bateman would use what he said were these – this is how he put it – impressions of Heavenly Father's will to encourage the young girls to engage in sexual acts. You don't have to be explicit here, of course, but can you just talk about the extent of the manipulation, what's going on?
From what we can tell from the federal court documents, it seems as if he was having some kind of sexual contact with at least one of his wives almost daily, and especially some of the younger ones. He would have contact with them at his home, so you take them out camping and have sex with them. The whole group, the adults that were involved too, were also involved in a lot of group sex activities that were kind of veiled in, you know, kind of this religion talk, but really it's just people having sex in the same room together, or some people have sex and then there's a video call with other people in other hotel rooms. And so there was a lot of group activity happening, which is interesting because that obviously creates a lot of witnesses. And so another kind of clincher in this prosecution is one of the followers, Julia Johnson, who is Moroni's wife, was there at some of these group sexual activities and saw this happening. And so then when, as Trent was mentioning, as she's becoming disillusioned or doubting this new prophet, she had this key eyewitness evidence then to go to the FBI because she was in the room. She saw a lot of this stuff actually happening in front of her.
But crucially, no one knew what Christine Marie and her husband were doing. And you report that Christine had this larger plan in mind. With Bateman out of the way, because he gets arrested. There's the raid. He gets arrested. And she figures that she would be able to, as you say in the piece, reason with his followers and soon convince them he was a predator and not a prophet. What was the plan? Because she had like put together like this slideshow.
Right. And Christine had, even before that, before his arrest, had in visits over to Sam's house where he's got all his wives living under this – in this small house. We call it the greenhouse. She'd been giving little classes about fashion or, you know, how to do different things, you know. So she'd been trying to become that person that they would look to for advice. And she has this plan that once Sam's gone, she'll be able to just teach them about – how these predators work, being influenced and different things, and their eyes will open and they'll see what happened to them. And of course, it's a lot more difficult than that.
Explain why.
Well, for one, she gets outed very fast.
Yeah.
As 9 of the underage wives are taken into protective custody and put in foster homes, the DCS process starts up, and some of the DCS reports indicate that there's an informant. And in fact, the wives kind of suspected that from the minute he was arrested. They were looking, who is it?
And a couple of – because these were very detailed, right?
Yeah. And when the FBI arrested Sam, they knew some of the wives' names already. And so immediately after he's arrested, they go over to Christine's house, and I happen to be there that first day, and they were trying to figure out who it was.
So what happens? Bateman's followers, the Samuelites, realize – she's ratted them out.
Yeah. They're enraged. And as soon as the wives realize that they've been outed by Christine and Tolga, they send a text over to Julia, and it says, "Yesterday afternoon, we got together and washed our feet against Moroni, Tolga, you and Christine. The epicenter of the earthquake was 1 mile from your house. We dare you to keep fighting." And there had been an earthquake in Colorado City that day. So
what's happened to Christine Marie and Tolga's involvement in that community now? If they're seen as, you know, snitches, can they still perform their work? Can they still do the acts of service that they had been doing for so many years?
Yeah, they feel they're in a better position now because for the FLDS, this Samuelite group was a big problem.
So now they're out of the way.
Yeah. So the FLDS people who are aware of the situation are very glad that Sam's now in prison and that this is over. So they see it as a good thing. They see it as fine, acceptable. So I don't think it's going to have much impact. And then on the other side, the people who were seeing Christine as an FLDS enabler because she would help people even if they still believed, I think those people now are reading this story and thinking, maybe there's more to this person than I thought.
How do you understand how sects like this, you know, an offshoot of an offshoot of an offshoot takes hold? It's not just credulous people. I can't imagine you're thinking. It's people who were raised in a certain kind of context. Like, how are you both thinking about all of that?
The more I read about what federal prosecutors have – the case that they were bringing – I'm not really sure that the men who followed him ever really believed he was a prophet. I think they wanted new wives, they wanted to have sex, they wanted children, and this was how they were going to get to that. And so the women that were following, you know, those are then the wives, their wives have no say in where they're going, if they're going to Sam, if they are going to follow this guy or not, because their husband is kind of in charge. And then you've got the children who have no power, and they're raised in this culture, as many of the defense attorneys for some of these wives say later, where they are raised to be perfectly obedient. Yeah. And you have to do anything that your husband tells you to do, or the prophet, or whoever, you know, is seen as the authority. And so, you know, this is something that has been taught to them from very young age as being FLDS, and just continued on in a more extreme way once the men in their lives, whether it was their father, husband, caretaker, told them, this is the guy you have to be listening to now.
Hmm. And it's interesting, too, when you think of the young women, the girls, what would they see in this guy? He's in his mid-40s. He's you know, just kind of a regular guy.
Yeah.
But when you look at the environment, they're taught to get married, to have kids, like we said, but they're not allowed to. So the younger women who are in their mid-20s, they've lost all this time where they wanted to be doing something different. And they have no exposure to modern media. They don't know who Justin Bieber is or Harry Styles. So this guy is actually pretty cool. He's got a white leather jacket. Maybe by
then drives a Bentley.
He's got the Bentley with and a couple Range Rovers, which we haven't mentioned.
Yeah.
And he's promising wealth and happiness and children and marriage. And so for somebody who's growing up in a community that has none of the resources we do to see what is really cool, he's pretty cool. And so it's this cultural field that's just ripe for a predator to come in.
So Sam Bateman was sentenced to 50 years in prison in this kind of arrangement where he admitted that he abused these child wives. So what happens next for the Samuelite movement? Will it last? Who's still following him? Is he going to be, I imagine, probably like Warren Jeffs, trying to sort of control people from inside a prison cell? Like, what's happening now?
This morning I heard from a source that we're probably down to about 15 followers from roughly 50 or so.
Hmm.
So there's some real diehard, and there may be more. It's hard to really get a clear window. You would think that his influence would wane in prison, but that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it strengthens. But I do think a lot of eyes are opening, and there are also several members serving time now.
Yeah.
And but the ones who got out seem to be on a healing journey, which is good to see. It's obviously not going to be easy, but there do seem to be positive signs.
Yeah, I want to add to that. You know, at the sentencing hearing, there were three of the girls who went and spoke, and it was really, really powerful to hear. I mean, most of these girls are still in foster homes, so they're they're removed from this community almost entirely. You know, to hear them telling Sam, "You no longer have any power over me." And they're talking about, you know, the things that any 17-year-old would be doing. She's in high school. There's a boy in school she's flirting with who's her age, and he's really cute. You know, she's, like, telling all these things about how, you know, this horrible thing that she could never consent to happened to her. And now in this new environment, she's finally doing all the things that just a 17-year-old girl should do. And so that was really powerful to hear, that it seems like a lot of these girls, I mean, obviously they're going to need a lot of therapy and things like that, but being in these foster homes and going through the therapy they have so far, they seem to be on the right direction and just kind of doing, like, normal things. Mm. Like, I'm getting ready for a date, like figuring out what kind of makeup you want to wear, you know, things that any girls those age should be figuring out.
That's Jessica Schreifels. She's an investigative reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. She reported the Sam Bateman story along with the photojournalist Trent Nelson. You can find a link to the reporting on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, Radio West listeners. It's Tim Slover, one of the producers for the show. And I wanted to tell you that from now until the end of the year, the BW Bastion Foundation is doubling every donation made in support of Radio West all the way up to $7,500. So go to RadioWest.org and click on the donate button to make your support go twice as far. Thanks a lot.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we reached out to Lindsay Hansen-Park to give us some perspective on this Sam Bateman story. She's a writer and a researcher, the executive director of the Mormon journal Sunstone, and she's been studying the FLDS community for years now. We began with one of the most glaring questions of this story, at least to me. That is, how is it that such a schlubby, unremarkable guy like Bateman could fill a power vacuum?
I think Warren Jeffs really showed the men under his rule how to take power. You can just claim it if you have a really good story. And Sam Bateman's story wasn't particularly unique, but he did something that I think is interesting that probably compelled a few folks that was different. Sam Bateman wasn't always the most worthy. In his youth, he was supposedly rebellious. And then, you know, the story goes that he gets in this accident, he has this brain injury, and then he sort of changes and becomes really rigid and black and white in his thinking. Other people say he was always like that, so I don't know that you can blame the brain injury. But he's not successful. He's not able to assume leadership like some of his brothers, some of his friends. So he kind of is on his own. He's an insurance agent. He's trying real estate, all of this stuff. He encounters, I would say, New Age spirituality. I don't know how he did that. I don't know if he was on the internet. But he starts integrating this idea of like manifestation and like coordinating it with FLDS doctrine. So when you listen to his tapes to his followers, he's talking a lot about dreams and manifestation. And he's not using New Age language, but he's using the ideas behind them. So he's saying, at one point he says, I have had this dream of this huge mansion and it's going to be built like this. And if I envision it, it will happen because that's how God works. If you envision it, then it opens the neural pathways. And I'm like, where does an FLDS guy get language like that, right? Yeah. So he, I think, studied New Age mysticism a little bit and brought that back. And I think people found that new and interesting.
So it seems like there's this material money aspect to part of his appeal, or anyway, the way he presents, certainly. You know, the Bentleys and the Mercedes and the leather jackets and stuff like that. But there's that story in the Tribune article about Bateman driving around in an SUV, pulling a flatbed trailer with all of his wives arranged in these neat rows. What's going on there? What are you seeing in that display?
I think it's this weird FLDS aesthetic because trailers have become a thing in the last few years. So again, Warren Jeffs really institutes this when he goes on the run from the government. So he's driving all over and he starts getting a fleet of his leaders to drive all over. And so they're trafficking women, children, and labor trafficking people all over from Mexico to Canada. They start using horse trailers to, again, these are rural people. A lot of their money comes from rural businesses, and so they use what they have. So they use horse trailers. I've seen horse trailers converted to baptismal fonts. I've seen them that look sort of replicate the LDS baptismal fonts. They're white inside. They've got white wainscoting. They've got white carpet, and they've got this font. And they drive them around to these groups that I talked about, missions of men who are out there working and allow them to be rebaptized for a fee to get them closer to repentance for their family. And so the fact that Sam Bateman sort of is ripping off Warren Jeffs' patterns is no surprise. I think that that's also how he gains trust from his followers, is he takes something that they recognize and values that they see as powerful or a symptom of God's divine origins, and he just replicates them. But he's sort of store brand about it. And I feel bad for his followers because, I mean, they're really getting the worst parts of Warren Jeffs, but they're also getting, you know, the lack of intelligence of Sam Bateman.
What is it that is in these are offshoots, and in some cases, offshoots of offshoots. But the original root, of course, was the original Mormonism. So I'm wondering, What is it in the original form of Mormonism that they're drawing from, if they are drawing from anything left there? Are these cultural attitudes? Are they religious doctrines that were a part of early Mormonism that they're stretching and making work?
This one is difficult for me because, you know, I grew up in this community. I have a lot of love for this community. There's a lot of beautiful things about this community, but I've had to wrestle with a lot of these stories and accept that my beloved ancestors were outlaws. I mean, they left the United States, presumably to come to Mexico and start their own, you know, country, Deseret. It didn't work out that way. But they were always in conflict with the law. They left because they were outlaws. And to be blunt about it, they were engaged in criminal activity. In Nauvoo, our ancestors were counterfeiting. They were breaking several laws, not just moral laws. But one of the things that was instituted was the act of secret marriages and secret polygamy. And that was pretty widespread amongst the high leadership. And when you do things that are outside the law, you do things in secret, you do things that are morally questionable, that bring a lot of controversy, and that can bring outside consequences like persecution, you have to build an architecture around those things that will get other people to accept and defend them. And so what we have in Mormonism, unfortunately, is almost 200 years of us building a framework to justify and excuse behavior that in a court of law would be, you know, considered criminal. And so that doesn't excuse someone like Samuel Bateman's actions, but it definitely explains this precedent of, it's not just, did Sam Bateman go off the rails and make these terrible decisions? Yes, and there's a whole reason that the community fell for it, because all of the rest of us have to explain and justify why it's okay for older men to be with younger women, to have multiple wives. And if you start to go down that road of justification, you're opening the door for a lot of really dark and pernicious things. And so the FLDS just became the natural conclusion to some of those worst shadow sides of Mormon doctrine that have been happening for 200 years.
What's left of the FLDS Church and the community down there? Like, what's the future? I'll put it this way. What stable doctrines or stable religious ideas or legal frameworks are still in place that may keep them there? Like, how are you thinking about that?
There's not a lot, actually. I mean, through Warren Jeffs's imprisonment and the prosecutions and capture of some of his co-conspirators and family members, their legal entity, you know, that was once an incorporated church has been stripped away. The whole structure of the church doesn't really have any sort of legal scaffolding around it anymore. It's very fractured. And the leadership is like that too. So there's not really an organized church anymore. There are little factions and families. And part of it has to do with when Warren Jeffs was, you know, separating families, he would assign what he called caretakers. So men with priesthood who would oversee a small group. Think of them as like bishops of a ward. They're sort of placed all around, you know, the United States and Canada and Mexico. So those people have sort of been left to their own devices. And depending on the morality of the individual caretaker depends on their outcome. So I've met folks who, I know a really good man named Randy Barlow, who was a caretaker, and he left with his whole group of women that he oversaw, and they got them all out. But unfortunately, a lot of men take that as an opportunity to step up and take the reins of power. And we've seen that over and over. So a lot of people are being run by families. There's a lot of old school patriarchs in the community that are running groups. And so there's a lot of individual stuff like that happening, but there's no organized structure anymore.
Hmm. Is it going to just dissipate over time?
I think it's going to morph. I think that's what we're seeing. We talk about religion dying. Religion isn't dying. The big religions are dying, but it's just morphing into something else. We're seeing wellness cults have a rise, you know, yoga cults. It's just morphing. Human beings need to make meaning. That's what we do. And unfortunately for folks in these communities, the framework of their theology is really poisonous, right? It's commodifying women and children. There's a lot of sexual abuse that's institutionalized into their doctrine. And so for a long time, I think those are going to fracture into really fringy, small, isolated sex cults. You know, I don't know if there's a better term. And that's really tragic. The best that we can do is try to make education as accessible as possible, get some resources to people so they can find a better way. But unfortunately, I think we're going to see this fracturing happen. Sam Bateman is just one of many, many men doing what he's doing.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's Lindsay Hansen Park. She's the executive director of the Mormon journal Sunstone, also host of the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. We just ended our year-end fund drive, and I'll just mention that from now until the end of the year, the B.W. Bastian Foundation is doubling every donation made in support of Radio West up to $7,500. So if you haven't yet, you can give at radiowest.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Kerry Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.